This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On June 16th, 2015, Donald Trump announced his candidacy for President of the United States.
Sadly, the American dream is dead. But if I get elected president, I will bring it back bigger and better and stronger than ever before, and we will make America great again.
On July 21st, 2016, Trump accepted the GOP's nomination.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
And on January 20th, 2017, Trump became the 45th president of the United States. Our guests today opened their new book with the question, Donald Trump says he alone can fix American democracy, but they ask, is he instead endangering it? Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt are professors of government at Harvard University, and for years they've been obsessively studying how authoritarianism rises and democracies fail around the world. And they apply that scholarship and analysis to the United States today. It's in their new book called How Democracies Die, and they join us in the studio. Professors Levitsky and Ziblatt, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So is American democracy dying?
Well, you know, we take a stand in this book, and we really think this is right. The democracy is neither dead nor dying. But there are certainly warning signs. And we're anxious, and we're worried about American democracy and both the election of Donald Trump, but really one of the points of our book, it's not about just Donald Trump. The problems run deeper than Donald Trump. And so that's really what we try to get at in this book.
And the problems certainly predate Trump. And I think Trump himself is a symptom of or a result of those challenges. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I wanted to play those two pieces of tape from when he announced in 2015 and from his nomination speech, because just even in those two moments, we hear, I think, strains of authoritarianism. But I guess what I want to ask you guys, you two, is in your book, you talk about how you've created a test, for example, of how to detect would-be autocrats before they get into office. So looking back at those two pieces of tape, for those two moments, for example, does Trump's candidacy pass your test?
Well, I think those clips show that he's a classic demagogue, and demagogues are often pretty dangerous for democracy. Now, what the indicators that we list in the book are certainly not a perfect litmus test. We call it a litmus test. It's not it's never foolproof. It's never possible to perfectly identify or always identify authoritarians before they come to office. But one of the things that we argue in the book is that it is much easier to stop an authoritarian before they come to power than afterwards. So
Right.
It's really important for political leaders, for political parties, to take very seriously what we call their gatekeeping task, identifying and taking steps to keep autocrats or potential autocrats from power. And we think, not necessarily in those clips, mm-hmm. but a number of things that Trump said and did during the campaign were clear indicators that he's not committed to democratic norms.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you ask is, does the person or the party align themselves with extremists before they come to power, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Then instead the need is to, in your words, refuse to endorse or align with those extremists. But when fear, opportunism, miscalculation leads to established parties bringing extremists into the mainstream, democracy is imperiled. Now, I would say that on that front, we are in an imperiled democracy then.
Yeah, so if you look around the world, the way in which electoral authoritarians often come to power is not just by getting elected, but as you say, being aligned with establishment politicians. And so this happened in the interwar years and the dramatic breakdown of democracy in the 1920s and 1930s, where establishment politicians in Italy, for example, aligned themselves with Mussolini, hoping to tap into his electoral power and his popularity, and it was a grave miscalculation. It backfired. Mussolini suddenly was, you know, launched into his into leadership position, and these establishment politicians were kind of sidelined. Same thing happened in the 1930s in Germany with establishment conservatives and Adolf Hitler. Similar things happened in Venezuela in the 1990s, where Hugo Chavez came to power in part by being aligned with President Rafael Caldera, who had freedom from jail and that way boosted Chavez's legitimacy. In each instance, the establishment politicians think that they're kind of they're forming a Faustian bargain where they think this is going to help them out, and it ends up backfiring.
So in the case of Trump and the current day and GOP leadership, we should because we should expand our analysis to political leaders in both parties, but it, specifically regarding the GOP, I mean, even though Trump denies it, he absolutely courted the far extreme right and in a certain sense continues to do so. They themselves say that he's using the language that, that the alt, quote-unquote alt-right has used. So, I mean, is that part of this pattern?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we do in the book is, as you mentioned, we have a litmus test. And so if a politician goes after the media, if they endorse violence— if they question the legitimacy of elections, if they threaten their rivals, you know, by you know to lock up their rivals or accuse their rivals of their political rivals of not being loyal to the country, these are clear hallmarks of an authoritarian. In addition to all of the offensive things he's said, you know, at a very basic, minimal level, if a politician does any of those four things that I just listed, we believe that the historical record suggests that establishment politicians must distance themselves from this kind of figure.
When Paul Ryan says, for example, when President Trump maligned a member of the federal judiciary because of his ancestry, and when Paul Ryan says, well, that's textbook racism, but I'm not going to do anything about it, what does that mean for our democracy?
It means that Republicans were abdicating their responsibility, their historic responsibility to defend democracy. Now, Republican establishment Republicans were in a tough place. He won the primary. They didn't have any institutional tools to stop him from winning the primary. He was able to potentially deliver them and did eventually deliver them the presidency, Congress, and perhaps the Supreme Court. So he could do a lot for them. And the base was with Trump. So this was not an easy position for someone like Paul Ryan to be in. And what they tried to do was basically at times hide under the desk and very frequently talk out of two sides of the mouth. So I don't approve of this. I distance myself from this particular act. But they never took the essential step in terms of defending democracy of breaking entirely with Trump. When establishment politicians and they knew this in private. You talk to any of these guys in private, they knew Trump was a demagogue. They knew he was a danger. They knew he was potentially authoritarian. And yet they took this risk.
Hmm. Well, there's another sort of part of your analysis where you talk about how, the health of a democratic system can also be measured by how much autocratic leaders are constrained once they're elected, you know, by the other aspects of government. And I'm going to get to that in a minute because there's much to discuss there. But I want to zoom out for a second here, because the one of the great strengths and uses of your book for all citizens who care about the health of American democracy is that you talk about trends, global trends, and specific examples around the world. And it's remarkable how you point out that before sort of Cold War and earlier, democracies fell in spectacular fashion, right? Military coup, for example. But that it's entirely different after the Cold War. What's that key difference?
The difference is it's far more likely today that democracy dies at the hands of elected leaders. In a majority, a pretty large majority of cases since the end of the Cold War, it's been elected presidents and prime ministers, often freely elected ones, who have disarmed democracy after being freely elected, who've used the tools and the institutions of democracy, paradoxically, to kill it or to wound it.
And you give the example, and maybe it's worth walking through it a little bit, of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Sure. Hugo Chavez was freely elected. Hugo Chavez governed in a fairly democratic manner in his initial years in office.
Survived a coup attempt, right? In fact,
the first anti-democratic move was clearly made by his opponents in 2002, and we argue that that was a, a serious, a consequential mistake on the part of the opposition. But eventually, the Chavez government slowly but surely began to go after the press, to punish independent media, to close down independent media, pack the courts, eventually begin to arrest opponents, exile opponents, and establish what is now a pretty authoritarian regime.
Mm. So what lessons, if any, can we draw from what happened in Venezuela to what's going on in the United States? Is it analogous at all?
Well, we have to be careful about the comparison because the United States is a much stronger democracy with much more robust democratic institutions than any of the other cases that we discuss in the book. Probably the closest comparison is actually Chile in the 1970s, mm-hmm. which is a very strong, very old democracy. Venezuelan democracy was relatively robust, but it was in a pretty severe crisis by the time that Chavez took office. So it's not perfectly analogous, but there are lessons, yes. And one of them, Daniel mentioned earlier, is that establishment politicians have to take every step possible to keep these guys out of office.
So tell me a little bit more about Chile, because are you referring to Allende or not? Because he was killed, he was murdered, that was a coup, right?
Right. That was during the Cold War.
Right.
So that was an old style democratic death, which is death by the men with guns. So that was a classic military coup. The reason I say it's analogous to the United States is that there actually are not very many fully democratic regimes and established, stable democratic regimes in the world that have collapsed. Chile is one of the few.
Okay.
That's why we look to Chile for lessons. But we're not arguing that it died at the hands of Allende. We're arguing that in that case it died at the hands of the military.
Right, and with assistance from foreign governments as well.
Right. I mean, indeed.
In the case of Chile.
One other important lesson I think that you can draw from the Chavez case is that democracies die slowly. And so, you know, it's hard for citizens and analysts when they're living through this to kind of recognize it.
So I want to ask you, because this idea, in your words, that democratic backsliding can begin at the ballot box is incredibly important for us to understand. Because in a sense, you know, there's that old saying that in a democracy, you get the leadership that you deserve. And I'm wondering if that's exactly what has happened here in the United States. We can have an argument about the Electoral College versus the popular vote. But I'm thinking that in a sense, Donald Trump, again, his rise is in part propelled by the fact that he was promising what many, many people in the electorate wanted. I mean, we were looking back at a January 2016 article from Matthew McWilliams, who was doing research through UMass Amherst. And he did polling across the country, and he wrote in January of 2016 that I have found a single statistically significant variable that predicts whether a voter supports Trump. It's not race, income, or education levels. It's desire for authoritarian leadership. I mean, he was detecting that back then. So I guess what I'm saying is those voters got what they wanted. They wanted authoritarianism or a form of it, maybe.
Well, that's what demagogues do, though, in some sense. What political leadership in part is about is not always responding to the impulses of publics. I mean, you know, this is a classical theme in democracy, and it's a paradox of democracy that democracy contains this vulnerability. And so, you know, the question is how do we keep such figures far from power? I think that's the issue, while addressing the underlying concerns that citizens genuinely may have.
Right. I want to take issue with the premise a little bit.
Sure.
I mean, there is pretty good evidence that Americans have long had an authoritarian streak. There has long and repeatedly throughout the last century been substantial public support, whether it's 30, 35%, nearly 40% of the electorate, willing to support extremist demagogues, whether it's Father Coughlin, whether it's Henry Ford,
George
who flirted
Wallace,
with the presidency,
right.
George Wallace, McCarthy, Huey Long before he was assassinated. There, throughout history, we have a number of cases of extremist demagogues with authoritarian inclinations, just like Trump, in some cases more authoritarian than Trump, with a lot of support. People vote for a lot of reasons. People vote in many cases without a lot of information, with a bunch of different priorities and a bunch of different things in mind. The real responsibility lies not with the voters. The responsibility lies with political leaders and political parties. We argue that it's ultimately the role of party leaders to make sure that demagogues don't get the nomination.
Okay, so then let's look to our own history then for guidance here. In those other cases, none of them were presidents, though. I mean, in those other cases,
because they were kept out by parties.
I was going to say, yeah. So exactly what did the parties do to buttress the democracy in those cases?
Yeah. Well, so until 1968, or really till 1972, we had a different way of selecting our candidates. So until 1972, party leaders often picked candidates in smoke-filled rooms, which doesn't have a good reputation. And this was a very exclusive system where at conventions, party leaders would get together and choose the candidates that they thought that would allow them to win. And they often worked up close with politicians and kept the guys that they feared out of office because they thought they wouldn't win. And so somebody like Henry Ford considered running for president, but it became very clear there was actually a survey done in the 1920s of party leaders, and he was very unpopular with Democratic Party leaders, whereas voters, he was very popular with voters. And so until the 1970s, we had a system in which party leaders picked candidates, and they, you know, and with, for all the problems, we're not arguing that we should go back to this.
I'm saying like the smoke-filled room doesn't, right. It sounds a step backward,
yes,
for democracy.
No, absolutely, right. So this in a way, but there's a lesson in that, which is that, you know, that there's a way in which our current system is, you know, it's clearly an improvement on the old system, but it's a double-edged system. I mean, it clears the way and makes the door, it opens the door for demagogues, the post-1972 election system.
But I feel like we are seeing, not just at the federal level, but at other levels in American governance, so many indications that our democracy is far more fragile than we thought. I mean, you guys write about this, the state of North Carolina, for example. You write about it extensively, but I'll just pick out one little fact that maybe folks know that it was just last year or a couple of years ago that the Electoral Integrity Project, also out of Harvard, basically said that North Carolina is so gerrymandered, voters are so disenfranchised, partisanship is so strong there that they can't even rate it as a democracy, a functioning democracy anymore. That's an American state. I mean, they put it right up there with Cuba. Or down there with Cuba, I should say. So, I mean, if that's also happening at the state level, again, are you looking to parties as being responsible for that?
Well, ultimately, what we think is responsible for the problems plaguing our democracy, I mean, there obviously are many things, but intense partisan polarization, probably the most intense polarization since Reconstruction, is leading our parties and our politicians, you're right, at the state level, sometimes at the local level, and now at the national level, to engage in the kind of a fairly reckless behavior in terms of our institutions that can put democracy at risk, or at very least turn our democracy into a completely dysfunctional system.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at some writing from Andrew Reynolds, who's at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he basically concludes that governance is not arbitrary. It follows established rules, and is based on popular legitimacy. So he sees there's a negative feedback loop there when popular legitimacy is allowing for the further dismantling of democratic norms. I mean, to that end, I just want to ask you about if we could go as deep as we possibly could, even deeper than the level of hyper-partisanship, about what's driving what seems like a slow erosion of American democracy. I mean, is it things like rampant inequality, racism, the weakening of public education, the adoption of policies by administrations that, you know, maybe Democratic and Republican, that aren't in the best interests of millions of Americans, and those things put together lead to this outcome of a weakening of democracy.
I don't think as political scientists we fully have the answer to this question yet. I mean, political scientists have been most of us have been somewhat late to the story here. I mean, it's with the election of Trump and with some of the institutional shenanigans that went on in recent years, for example, North Carolina, political scientists began to ask this question of why American democracy seems to be sliding into crisis. But we're just really beginning to ask these questions, with a few exceptions. I think one of the factors, which is we touch on in the book but don't develop much in the book, is almost unprecedented inequality. We now have reached levels of income inequality higher than any time since before the Depression, and by some measures, close to highest levels of income inequality ever, mm-hmm. in this country. Mm-hmm. there's no question that that is corroding the quality of our democracy, that it is contributing to this immense gap between everyday voters and the elite, and is leading in fueling things like populism. Trump, at an important level, is a populist figure. Now, the primary focus, though, of the book is a little bit different. We think that race and culture ultimately are driving this polarization. Three things have happened since the 1960s to contribute to this. First of all, the civil rights movement and the success of the civil rights movement led to a massive migration of Southern whites from the Democratic to the Republican Party. Secondly, large-scale immigration transformed the demographics of this country, and the vast majority of immigrants ended up in the Democratic Party. And third, since Reagan, we have a massive migration of evangelicals, which used to be in both parties, equally split between both parties, are now overwhelmingly Republican. So whereas in the 1950s and the 1960s, even the early 70s, both parties were demographically very similar. They were basically both white Christian parties through the 1960s. Now we have two parties that are demographically very different. The Democrats are a party of basically urban educated whites or urban secular whites and a diversity of ethnic minorities. And the Republicans have become essentially a white Christian party.
So let me just jump in here. Are you saying that one of the reasons why our democracy, why our democracy may be imperiled, is racism?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. What's happening is that, so white Christians are not just any group, right? White Christians were a dominant electoral majority not long ago. And more than that, white Christians sat atop every economic, social, cultural, and political hierarchy that we had in this country, right? They were fixtures of local communities. They were the people who ran the businesses. They were the newscasters. They were the sports heroes. They were the politicians. They filled the presidency, Supreme Court, Senate, governor mansions. This is not that
they
long
were,
ago, right?
They were the nexus of power, exactly.
So our society has transformed over 50 years. And many white Christians, not all Republican voters, but many Republican voters feel like the country that they grew up with is being taken away from them.
Understood. And this now, is we've heard this before, but what I guess what I'm saying is, what does it say about the inherent strengths or weaknesses of the American democratic experiment that if in this evolution, this transformation, we're talking about how American democracy might die?
Here's what we think it says. The democratic norms that sustained us in the 20th century in many, many positive ways, in which the two parties accepted each other as legitimate and basically played nice, that was founded on racial exclusion. That was those norms were created and sustained in an overwhelmingly white Christian society. They were created on the back of the racial exclusion of post-Reconstruction. It was essentially the Republicans' willingness, going back to the 1870s, the Republicans' willingness to abandon racial equality and to allow for the massive disenfranchisement of African Americans and the establishment of single-party authoritarian rule in the South and white supremacy in the South. That move in the 1870s is what allowed the two parties to come together and what allowed for the engendering and the sustaining of democratic norms in this country. What we haven't done yet is adapt to a society, a diverse society based on racial equality.
So to get us back to the question of parties and their role in all of this, this leaves me feeling very depressed because it's the very same party leadership, specifically I'm going to say on the Republican side, that I don't see making any moves, having any drive or any meaningful desire to change this trajectory. You're shaking your head. Maybe am I being too pessimistic here?
So there's things for politicians and for parties to do on both sides. So, I mean, one of the things that we think is that the Democratic – well, first of all, the Republican Party needs to diversify. I mean, and the processes and phenomena that Steve is describing here
– I mean, it made attempts under George W. Bush. There was the big tent Republicanism.
Right. And they fell short, and there's lots of reasons, you know, maybe why that happened. But, I mean, at the end of the day, what we think needs to happen is that the Republican Party needs to refound itself and become a viable a party that can appeal to a broader swath of the American
electorate. Give me a little bit of hope, because you talk about how a sort of a party reckoning is possible, and you look to the former West Germany.
Yeah.
West Germany as an example. Yeah. Can you just briefly tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, so one of the key shapers of German political life through the 19th and 20th century was a dysfunctional right in Germany, and was only after World War II that the German center right was refounded on a democratic basis. And so that's a model, but it's not a very exciting model at some level, because what was required was the devastation and tragedy of World War for the right to finally understand in Germany that it needed to be refounded on a democratic basis. The other part of that transformation in the German center right after World War II, which the U.S. played a major role in helping Germany democratize, but a major part of this was that it was this deep religious divide, similar to the kinds of religious divides that Steve is describing in the U.S. between Catholics and Protestants, had split the right for a century. And after 1945, for the first time, these two different segments of German society, Catholics and Protestants, who had despised each other and gone to a civil war with each other, joined together and created the Christian Democratic Party. Mm. Angela Merkel's party was a Protestant/Catholic party. And so, again,
we can ask how long that's lasting, though, right? Because
right.
It's her very party right now that seems to be in trouble with,
yes.
once again, the rise of the extremist right in Germany. But I've gone way over time here. I have one last question very briefly, if I could, because this is so vitally important. I mean, you close your book by saying that you quote Daniel Ellen, also from Harvard, the remarkable Daniel Ellen, that basically the challenge, a great American challenge, is that we as a nation are trying to attempt something that has never been attempted before in humanity, right? In her words, it says, build a genuine multi-ethnic democracy where political, social, and economic equality are all achieved. Given everything that we've just talked about for the past half hour, do you still believe that is indeed actually possible in the United States?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, this requires creative political leadership. It requires active citizenry. And these are the things, that we hope can happen. And one of the purposes of the book is, to look beyond just Donald Trump and to kind of put the full scale of the challenge in front of us.
Yeah. Look, if any democracy in the world is going to do it, it's ours. We have the oldest, most successful constitution in the world. We have very robust democratic institutions. We are a society that has successfully assimilated ethnic minorities in the past. We shouldn't forget how successful we were in the early part of the 20th century in assimilating other ethnic minorities. So, if there's a country in the world that's capable of doing it, it's ours.
Well, the new book is How Democracies Die. It's by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. Professors, thank you so very much for coming in. It's a remarkable book, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.